Chapter 42. Saturday. Malta. The drive from Berlin to Frankfurt was just over an hour, and they were careful to obey the speed limit. By the time they arrived at the airport, it was shortly before sunrise. Moving people and black market antiquities through any airport, much less one the size of Frankfurt International, required a network of people on the take. Eichel had given all of them up. Hoping to purchase his freedom, he had surrendered the names and phone numbers of everyone at the airport who was working for him. He would have to do a lot more than rat his associates out, though, and Harvath had explained what it was. Eichel had nodded in agreement and had begun making phone calls. There was a small checkpoint entrance on the far northeast side of the airport. When they pulled up, it was unmanned. Within seconds, the yellow concrete bollards in front of them lowered. The gate drew back, and the red and white striped security arm blocking their way was raised. "Open sesame," Hermann remarked, as he drove onto the airport grounds and headed for the civil aviation area. Outside a windowless gray hangar, a German customs and immigration official sat in a white Mercedes waiting for them. When they pulled alongside, the man rolled his window down, and Harvath handed over an envelope. After counting the money, the official wished them a good flight, rolled his window up, and drove away.
"It pays to know people," said Hermann, as he watched the Mercedes drive off. "I never get through the airport this fast."
It hadn't been cheap. While Eichel's man was crooked, he wasn't stupid. He had made sure he was well compensated for his risk. Helen Cartland, the CIA's Berlin station chief, had flat out refused the amount of money Harvath had requested. Lydia Ryan had to call from Langley and order her to release it. When Cartland showed up at the produce warehouse to deliver the cash, she presented Harvath with a receipt and demanded that he sign it. She didn't want her ass on the line for such a large sum. Harvath shook his head and signed her slip of paper. "Are you kidding me?" she asked when she read his signature. "Just incredible." He winked at her and had Bosch walk her back out to her car as they finished getting the prisoners ready. Then, once they were all prepped, they were loaded into the trunk of the BMW. Bosch and Farber followed in Harvath's vehicle, which they would be returning for him. Inside the hangar, a sleek Bombardier Global 6000 business jet owned by the CIA was waiting. Hermann and his men helped him board and secure the prisoners. All three were wearing blindfolds, hoods, and earmuffs. Hermann offered to come along to help with security, but Harvath turned him down. It was a short flight. He'd be fine. They said their goodbyes at the bottom of the air stairs. Harvath thanked Hermann and his men for their help. 15 minutes later, he had a mug of hot coffee in his hand. The powerful aircraft was thundering down the runway, and the sun had begun to rise. Harvath sat back in his chair and watched out the window as the pilots banked and turned the jet south toward the Mediterranean. Normally, this would have been a prime opportunity for him to get some sleep, but with prisoners on board, that was out of the question. Instead, he used the time to let his mind wander. There were still so many questions he didn't have the answers to. No sooner had he begun to list them than they began to crash up against each other like a pileup on a busy interstate. He had questions about Sala, Malevsky, and Sasha Basayev. What the Russians knew, what they didn't know. What was next, and who was responsible. It was all Harvath could do not to start interrogating Sergen right there on the plane. Lydia Ryan, though, had been absolutely specific on how it was to be handled. The instructions had come from her boss, Director McGee, and Harvath knew that McGee had issued the orders based on the wishes of the president. He would have to wait until he got to Malta. As he watched the blue-black sky turn orange, he thought about Lara. It had been days since he had spoken with her. She'd be back in Boston by now. Knowing her, she'd probably spent a little time with her family and then headed right into the office, jet-lagged be damned. Staring at the three hooded figures in the back of the plane, he took a sip of his coffee. It was hard to say that this was better than being in Boston with Lara. For a moment,
He thought about what moving to Boston might be like. D.C. was where his career was. At least, that was what he had always told himself. Working at the Carlton Group had a lot of upside. His boss was a legend in the spy game, the money was fantastic, and even though the old man had not directly said it, he was grooming Harvath to take over one day. But what did that mean? It was a question he knew the answer to, but had never really thought about. It meant running the business, schmoozing politicians, glad-handing agency heads, winning contracts. He'd be trading in fieldwork for paperwork, covert operations for conference rooms. He knew plenty of guys who had gone corporate, men who had traded being Tier 1 for the Fortune 500, or who had completely set up their own businesses. In return, they had received a semblance of stability. Freed from the relentless tempo of being elite operators, they could now have their chance to enjoy the American dream. They bought boats and summer houses, took long vacations, and went on epic hunting and fishing trips. They were living the dream. But get a couple of drinks into them, and they'd tell you that they missed the action, that nothing matched it, that as much as they loved their new careers and being with their wives and families, the old life never stopped calling. It was an itch that just couldn't be scratched. There was also the sense of purpose. None of the men Harvath had known had been in it for the money. They were there because they believed in the mission and the men who were fighting alongside them. It was a calling, and as such, extremely difficult to walk away from. Harvath took another sip of coffee and looked back out the window. He had never considered that Reed Carlton might pull him from the field before he was ready to leave it behind. It was crazy that it hadn't crossed his mind before. When the old man was ready to hang it up, he was going to hang it up. It wouldn't matter where Harvath thought he was more valuable or where he wanted to be. Carlton would have already made up his mind. He would have thought everything out. He would have anticipated every rebuttal Harvath might raise. He'd have an offer for him, and it would be fantastic. And knowing Harvath as well as he did, he'd have an ironclad justification ready as well. The old man would appeal to Harvath's sense of duty and patriotism. He'd explain why the country needed him to give up field work and helm the Carlton Group. Finally, he would appeal to his sense of loyalty. None of it would be pretty. And frankly, Harvath had no idea how he might respond. What he did know was that once the offer had been made, their relationship would have crossed a Rubicon. There would be no going back to the way things were before. That wasn't how Carlton operated. He was incredibly stubborn and single-minded when it came to the business and what he thought best served the needs of the country. You either followed his advice, or he advised you to hit the road. Things were black, or they were white. There was no gray. But while there was no gray with the old man, there was the agency. In fact, there was green, and in more ways than one. Harvath was reminded of his conversation with Helen Cartland in the pub back in Berlin. She had asked him what kind of green badger he was. Was he a private contractor or corporate? In his time working with the CIA, he had learned about a hybrid type of contractor. Something called Spectal, a combination of someone who was sometimes a private contractor and sometimes a corporate contractor. But for that to happen, Carlton would have to want to keep him around. If Harvath said no to moving into a leadership role at the company, he doubted that was going to be an option. The old man would cut ties. That was just the way he was. If he wanted to stay in the field, going the private route might be the answer. He would be giving up a lot by leaving the Carlton Group, but he stood to gain so much in return. The CIA wouldn't care if he lived in Boston or Bangladesh. All they cared about is that when they called, he picked up the phone. Becoming a private contractor for the agency would allow him to do what he loved to do, and do it from Boston. He'd have to give up his house, and there was also the chance that the president wouldn't be happy with his decision, but how much would that matter? He wasn't hanging up his cleats. He'd just be using a different locker room. If the president wanted him for something, he could still find him. He just wouldn't be right down the road. The more he thought about it, the more the pieces started falling into place. For a moment, he had to stop himself and ask if this was really what he wanted to do. Was he actually going to leave the Carlton Group? He was tired. His head wasn't on straight. It was a crazy idea. Certainly not something he should be thinking about in the middle of an operation. Pondering the future wasn't something he could afford to do right now. He needed to focus on the present. He turned his mind back to all the questions that had been piling up like a chain reaction car crash in his brain. He pulled at a thread here, a thread there, trying to unravel what it all meant. He was on his third cup of coffee, and no closer to any answers when the plane began to descend, and Harvath looked back out the window. They were over the water, just south of Sicily. Double-checking the prisoners, he returned to his seat and buckled up. It felt odd to be returning. His last visit had marked a low and very dark time for him. He had stayed drunk for days, and had even taken a shot at the man he was about to see. Hopefully, he'd already put that behind him. If Harvath had wanted to kill him, he would have. It had only been a warning shot. Some people, though, had a way of carrying a grudge, especially those who had been shot at. Chapter 43. The interrogation facility was located about a half hour outside the town of Valletta. It had been built to resemble a rural Maltese farmhouse. The guts of the operation were below ground in a series of tunnels and windowless cells that had been nicknamed the Solarium. A man named Vella ran the program. He had PhDs in psychiatry and neurochemistry and was considered one of the best interrogators in the business. He was the one Harvath had shot at. Vella and his team were waiting as the jet landed and taxied inside the private hangar. As soon as the pilot shut down the engines and lowered the stairs, Vella and his team came aboard.
"Flight okay?" Vella asked, as his men got the prisoners ready to deplane. "Any trouble?"
Harvath shook his head.
"Good. My car's outside," he replied,
waving Harvath toward the cabin door. He was a couple of inches shorter than Harvath, lean, with dark hair and glasses. He didn't look like some mad scientist. He looked like an accountant. Harvath grabbed his bag and followed him out to the car.
"Hungry?"
Vella asked as they climbed into his silver Jaguar. He was.
"Can we pick up something on the way? I want to get started with the interrogation as soon as possible."
"Don't worry. We've got time." When Harvath had been given permission to transport Sergun and the other two to the Solarium, the old man had explained that Vella would be running the show. Harvath was expected to follow his lead.
"Breakfast or lunch?"
he asked as they left the airport and pulled out onto the main road.
"Lunch,"
Harvath replied. Vella nodded, pressed the button to open the sunroof, and pushed down on the accelerator. Harvath lowered his window. The sun was bright and it was warm outside. He could smell the ocean. It felt good being close to the water. 20 minutes later, they pulled off onto a dirt road and kept going. There were no houses, no shops, nothing. They were in the middle of nowhere. Harvath's antennae were beginning to stand up. Then he saw it. It was half beach cottage, half shack, surrounded by a faded picket fence. A brightly colored rowboat was pulled up onto the beach in front. Two old men worked repairing a large fishing net. Vella parked his car and motioned to follow him inside. The front of the restaurant was open to the ocean. They were shown to a small table and offered menus.
"Is there anything you don't eat?" Vella asked.
"Brains and intestines," Harvath replied.
Vella laughed and ordered in Maltese for both of them. When the waitress left to place their order, Harvath said,
"Listen, I owe you an apology."
Vella held up his hand.
"No, you don't. I shot at you."
"If you had intended to hit me, would you have?" Harvath nodded.
"Then you didn't shoot at me, you shot near me. There's a difference.
In your case, it was a subtle difference, but a difference nonetheless."
I apologize.
It's in the past, Vella replied. Let's talk about the present.
What do you want to know?
How you broke Eichel and Malevsky, and then what specifically it is you want me to get from Sergun.
Did they send you my reports? Harvath asked.
Vella nodded. I read everything. I just wanted to see what else you could provide. Even small things. Things that may seem inconsequential can sometimes help me. Harvath began speaking, but paused as the waitress returned with their drinks. Once she had gone again, he continued. Vella didn't write anything down. He simply listened, only breaking in when he wanted clarification. By the time their food arrived, he had told him everything he could remember about all three prisoners. The lunch was fantastic. Fresh prawn carpaccio, aglio, which was a traditional fish soup, and for their main course, a ribeye of veal with wild mushrooms. By the time Harvath was done eating, he felt even more tired than he had on the flight in. Vella ordered espressos, a double for Harvath, and paid the bill. When they were done with their coffees, they returned to the car and continued on to the solarium. Even with his knowledge of Arabic, the road signs were difficult to read. Maltese was an interesting language, to say the least. Arriving at the farm, Vella checked Harvath in, issued him a security card, and showed him to his room.
I'm going to start with Malevsky first, the interrogator said. I want to gather as much intel as I can before I sit down with Sergun, okay?
Your house, your rules, Harvath replied.
Vella smiled.
Give me 2 hours, and then come down. Will do.
As the man left and closed the door behind him, Harvath tossed his bag on the end of the bed and began unpacking. He then texted a quick update to Lydia Ryan and took a long, hot shower. After shaving and changing his clothes, he set the alarm on his phone and lay down on the bed. Within seconds, he was asleep. An hour later, his alarm went off. Though he could have used a lot more sleep, he at least felt a little refreshed. Pulling a bottle of water from the small fridge in the room, he drank half of it and headed downstairs. He knew his way from the last time he had been here. It was at the end of his last assignment. He had been given a list of kills to carry out. They were elites, untouchables scattered across Europe. They had been responsible for the terrible pandemic that had swept the globe. The last person on his list had been a South African, a prisoner at the solarium. Harvath had brought him to Malta himself. The South African had worked for the elites. He had helped make their plan possible. He had killed scores and scores of innocents. He was the last link in the chain, and Harvath had killed him with his bare hands. Then, he had chased everyone out of the solarium and had gotten drunk. He had stayed drunk for days. It was the only way he could deal with what he had seen and what he had done. When Vella came to check on him, that's when he had fired a shot at him. 36 hours later, a friend walked into the cell Harvath was camped in and sat down. They drank and they talked. They sat there until Harvath was ready to leave. It was indeed one of the lowest points of his life. He had done what he had needed to do, what he had been assigned to do. Once he felt ready, he had flown back home. He and Lara, along with her parents and little boy, had retreated to Alaska. Harvath had friends there who had a fishing lodge. It was a good place to ride out the next 4 weeks, a safe, remote place to hide from the infection. Then, as quickly as the disease had appeared, it disappeared, all but burning itself out. Every nation had suffered, some worse than others. The amazing thing was how quickly normal life had returned. No matter what nature threw at mankind, mankind always seemed to find a way to rebound. Nevertheless, Harvath still carried the demons with him. He saw the faces of the dead and the dying. He felt responsible, as if somehow he could have changed the outcome, somehow stopped it. But based on what he had known and how far he'd had to go to get answers, he couldn't have stopped it. The wheels had already been in motion. The virus had been set loose before anyone knew what was happening. The men behind the attack didn't send out polite announcements drawing attention to what was coming. It wasn't his fault. What about Anbar, though? The SAD team was there because of the intelligence Harvath had received from Sala. They were so convinced it was solid, they had bet everything on it. Then, the team and the helicopter contingent had gotten wiped out. Next came the assassination of the Secretary of Defense, his security team, and the suicide bombing at the White House. All of that led from Sala to Sasha Basayev and now to the man in the cell downstairs, Colonel Viktor Sergun. He was the man with the answers Harvath wanted. In light of that, it probably made sense that Vela was in charge of this interrogation. Harvath wouldn't have been subtle. He would have been brutal. The death of Valeri Kumarin had been an accident. Harvath hadn't intended to kill him when he showed up at Malevsky's estate, but that had been the result. Perhaps DC was trying to safeguard against any more accidents. Whatever the reasoning, the call had been made. He was an observer now. Vela had full authority. He was the one calling all the shots. Harvath would act accordingly. As he walked down the stairs, he looked forward to watching the interrogation of Viktor Sergun. Chapter 44. The White House, Washington, D.C. Almost 24 hours had passed since the suicide bombing. The north portico, which functioned as the front door to the White House, was badly damaged. Scaffolding had been erected to block it from view. Emblazoned across it was a billowing American flag. In a trend just as disturbing as the Secret Service's reluctance to apply maximum force to trespassers, the president had refused to be evacuated. He had been in the West Wing when the bomber detonated. His security detail had immediately rushed him to the underground bunker, formerly known as the Presidential Emergency Operations Center. They watched the unfolding pandemonium on the cable and television networks, whose cameras were permanently encamped on the north lawn. Once it became obvious that it was a suicide bomber, and that several minutes had passed with no follow-on attack, President Porter had wanted to leave the bunker to assist the wounded. The Secret Service didn't need to restrain him. His entire senior staff jumped up to stand in his way. "Absolutely not," his chief of staff said. "No way." When Porter tried to push past, his national security director stated, "You know how these people operate. The first bomb draws everyone in, the second takes everyone out." "Look at the feeds," Porter insisted, pointing to all the television monitors in the room. "The first responders are already up there. There isn't a second bomb." "We don't know that," the vice president replied. "Please, Paul, let's just wait." "Those are our people up there," he fired back. "I'm not going to have it said the president of the United States cowered in a bunker while they needed help." Now it was the press secretary's turn to step in.
"Nobody will say that, Mr. President. Right now, though, you need to be kept safe. The nation is going to want to hear from you."
His lead Secret Service agent, a man named Chudwin, drew the chief of staff aside and made his case to evacuate the president to the continuity of government facility in West Virginia. Porter saw them speaking and interrupted. "Agent Chudwin," he said, "we are not leaving. That is final. Am I understood?" Chudwin looked at the chief of staff and then to the president. "Yes, sir." What he liked even less than cowering in the bunker was abandoning ship. With the issue settled, he looked at his press secretary. "I want to give a national address."
"When?" she responded.
"As soon as possible. Just a few brief remarks to show everyone we're still here and to reassure the American people that we will respond to this attack." The press secretary looked at her watch.
"Give me 20 minutes to write something up."
"And I want to do it from the Oval." The press secretary looked at the president's lead Secret Service agent. Chudwin shook his head.
"I don't think that's a good idea, sir."
"Duly noted," replied Porter, who looked back at his press secretary and stated, "We're doing it from the Oval." An hour and a half later, Stations around the world broke into their programming to carry the president's brief address. Porter was a gifted speaker and had struck the right tone. He praised the Secret Service for its bravery, extended his heartfelt prayers for the dead and wounded, as well as their friends and families, and then announced his resolute determination to avenge the attack. It was a very specific choice of words. Some of his predecessors had preferred the phrase, "bring the perpetrators to justice." Bringing perpetrators to justice was what you did with purse snatchers or bank robbers. This attack hadn't been a criminal act. It had been an act of war. Porter didn't want to put the perpetrators in prison. He wanted to put them in the ground. If once America found them, there were enough pieces left to justify using a casket. When the address was complete, the president joined his National Security Council in the Situation Room. They had been practically living there ever since. With Washington's network of security cameras, the FBI had been able to gather a significant amount of intelligence. They already had CCTV footage of the bomber as she walked several blocks to the White House, though her point of origin was unclear. The bomber's walk had started somewhere within an area where there were no cameras. They were assuming that she had exited from either a building or a vehicle. The two-block area in question had been completely sealed off. FBI agents were combing it methodically, which meant the search was very slow-going. The Bureau's biggest concern was that when or if they found a car, a van, or an apartment belonging to the bomber, it might be rigged with explosives. They were using robots, dog teams, and everything else at their disposal to get to the bottom of it. In the meantime, the banner the bomber carried had been identified as the flag of ISIS. They had all suspected as much. The big question now was whether the bomber had been inspired by ISIS or actually directed by them. For his part, President Porter had grown unforgiving of the distinction. As long as ISIS called for attacks against the West, America in particular, the responsibility was on them. But what about the Russians? Harvath had been able to draw a line from his murdered informant in Belgium to the GRU. He had even learned that a GRU operative had flown from Frankfurt to Antalya right around the time of the attack on Secretary Devin. That didn't mean, though, that the Russians had been involved. In order to allege, much less act on something that serious, he was going to need proof. Ironclad proof. Right now, though, they had to assemble a response to ISIS. America's previous attack had dominated global headlines for the last 72 hours. The phone at the White House was still ringing off the hook from world leaders. But in the blink of an eye, the United States had lost the propaganda initiative. ISIS had been able to strike the White House itself. It was an amazing coup. The Joint Chiefs of Staff had been assembled at the Pentagon. A secure video conference link connected them with the bunker. Porter addressed the chairman. "Your thoughts regarding a response, General?" The man tapped his pencil onto the pad of paper in front of him. "My guess is the attack on the White House was in the works before we hit them with Operation Iron Fury." "Agreed." "And all the intel we're getting here says that we kneecapped them pretty good. We can put together any kind of response you ask for, Mr. President. But what we'd need to know is what you're looking for."
"Meaning?"
"Meaning," the general replied, "do you want something that's proportional or disproportional?" It was a fair question, and one that Porter had already been thinking about. "Let's say we wanted to deliver an equally symbolic message. What would it take to blow the front doors of ISIS headquarters right off their hinges?" "Well, for starters, we'd actually have to find their headquarters," said the general. "And if we can do that?" asked the president. "If you can do that, we'll give you the most unbelievably symbolic response you've ever seen." Chapter 45. Malta.
"You really messed him up," Vella said, as Harvath joined him in his office.
"His knee is shattered. He's probably going to walk with a limp for the rest of his life."
Harvath picked up the scan and looked at it.
Do you offer dental exams, too?
We work up each one that comes through. We don't want any unforeseen medical conditions tanking an interrogation. Despite some of its stomach-churning practices, the solarium was highly scientific. Harvath understood the need to give prisoners workups. It not only helped identify potential problems, but also provided baselines, which allowed them to identify when techniques were working.
Did Malevsky give you anything useful? Harvath asked.
A couple of things, Vela replied. Mostly background, but I think it could be helpful. In the meantime, I need updated proof of life. Can you get your contact to take photos? Consulting his notes, he added, he wants a picture of each girl in the kitchen near her favorite appliance.
What does that mean?
He says the girls will know. Harvath removed his phone to text Alexandra.
What's the password for your Wi-Fi?
Vela gave it to him. Harvath entered it into his phone and sent the message.
I'll let you know as soon as I get something back from her. Now, what about Sergun?
Vela picked up a remote and clicked on one of the TVs hanging on the wall. A hooded figure sat with his feet chained to the floor and his wrists cuffed to a track that ran down the center of a stainless steel table.
What are you waiting for? Harvath asked.
The interrogator opened a drawer in his desk, removed what looked like a small pill bottle, and handed it to Harvath.
Open it.
The moment Harvath did, he regretted it. He only caught a small whiff of what was inside, but it was enough to cause his chest to tighten and his pulse to race. Replacing the cap, he handed it back to Vela.
That's awful.
Now you know what fear smells like. Harvath shook his head to get the lingering odor out of his nostrils.
What are you talking about? What is that stuff?
It's a synthetic.
Synthetic what?
Vela thought for a moment and replied, certain species are capable of excreting chemical factors which can trigger social responses.
Pheromones, Harvath stated.
Precisely. And when these chemical factors are released, they impact the behavior of the receiving individual. There are many different kinds of pheromones in the animal world that affect behavior and physiology. There are alarm pheromones, sex pheromones, and even fear pheromones. This last pheromone is particularly interesting, especially as it relates to human beings, both in groups as well as in individuals. Essentially, what we have learned is that fear can be chemically induced, and it can be done so via smell. These guys were way too into their work. They were always developing new interrogation techniques, ways to break people and get them to comply.
Let me guess, said Harvath. You're pumping the interrogation room full of it right now.
Are you kidding me? Vela replied. I wouldn't be able to work in there if I did.
So, how are you introducing it?
Vela walked over to the monitor and pointed to the hood Sergun was wearing. See this part here, right around his nose and mouth? Harvath looked. The fabric appeared darker.
What about it?
That's actually a pocket. We placed pieces of fabric inside, soaked with the synthetic pheromone.
So he's breathing it.
Vela nodded.
Does that actually work? Harvath asked.
We'll see. 15 minutes later, Vela turned up the volume on the monitor and excused himself. Harvath remained behind in the office to watch. Moments later, he heard the heavy bolt on the interrogation room door being pulled back, and then the squeal of hinges as it was opened. One of the guards closed and locked the door behind him after Vela had entered. It was interesting for Harvath to watch how someone else conducted an interrogation. Normally, he was the one doing it. He didn't usually get to observe other people work. Vela took his time. He moved quietly to the far corner of the room, leaned back against the wall, and watched his prisoner. By now, the earmuffs and the blindfold had been removed from Sergun. The only deprivation he was suffering was due to his restraints and the hood over his head. During his medical workup, adhesive sensors had been placed at different points on his skin. Now, somewhere in the solarium, a tech had hit a button and the man's vital signs could be seen across the bottom of the TV monitor. Sergan's heart rate had gone up since the door had opened and Vela had entered the room. He was keenly aware of the man's presence. Vela, though, did nothing. He remained in the corner, leaning against the wall, watching. Harvath could only imagine what was going through Sergan's mind at the moment. Most likely he was trying to remember all of his training. Deny, 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 and launch counter-accusations. That's what all good spies were taught. After 5 more minutes, Vela approached. He stood very close, almost on top of him. Harvath leaned forward to figure out what he was doing. Then Vela carefully removed the hood and stepped away. The 58-year-old Sergun was a good 40 pounds overweight. His pasty white face was round and puffy. His jowls shook as his eyes adjusted to the light, and he twisted his head left and then right. His gray hair was cut in a buzz cut, military style.
"I understand that you speak English," said Vela.
As his eyes focused, they came to rest on his interrogator, and he nodded.
"Good," Vela continued. "Do you know where you are?"
Sergun shook his head.
"It has many names. Some have compared it to Dante's Seventh Circle, where the violent are bathed in a boiling river of blood and fire. Others, though, have compared it to Paradise, a place where their prayers are finally answered, where they find release."
The Russian remained still. His face was stony and impassive. His eyes, though, told a different story. Harvath could see it even on the CCTV footage. And if he could see it, that meant Vela did too.
"What would you like to accomplish here?" Vela asked.
It was a bizarre question, almost better suited for a job interview or a self-help seminar. Vela moved back to his corner of the room, leaned back against the wall, and waited. He was in no hurry. Harvath glanced back at the graphic with Sergun's vitals. His heart rate had increased. Sergun eventually summoned the will to speak.
"What do you want?"
he asked. Vela smiled. "I want you to answer for your sins."
"I have no sins."
The interrogator's smile never wavered. "We all have sins, Victor. We all must atone. I'm here to help you."
"You are not here to help me,"
the Russian insisted. He was growing more agitated. His voice cracked as his vitals climbed.
"Let me go. I want to leave."
"Everyone wants to leave."
"Let me go."
Harvath watched the monitor as the man became more distraught. He could see the whites of his eyes wide with fear. The pheromone was working. Vela moved off the wall and reached for a spare chair. Drawing it gently over, he sat down next to the prisoner.
"I understand that in Russia, you read Dante. Do you recall the Inferno?"
Sergun began to tremble.
"Who was in the ninth circle, Victor?"
"The devil,"
he whispered.
"Lucifer."
"That's right. You're with the devil now. And no one knows you're here. No one is coming to save you," said Vela. "You can scream. You can cry out. But only I will hear you."
Removing a pair of pliers, he then ordered,
"Spread your fingers."
The stainless steel table Sergun was shackled to was like a medieval rack. The track down the center was mechanical. When the Russian refused to comply, Vela depressed a button that pulled his wrists forward while his ankles remained chained to the floor. He began screaming almost immediately. 20 minutes later, the Russian had been broken. Vela looked up at the interrogation room's camera in a subtle acknowledgement of Harvath. Then, returning his gaze to Sergun, he said,
"Tell me about the GRU, Victor. Let me help you leave. Let me help you go home."
Chapter 46. Harvath used the Solarium skiff, a small secured room for transmitting top-secret information, to provide a full report to Washington. He had been in there for hours. No one wanted to believe it. Harvath didn't want to believe it. But once the shock of Sargon's revelations began to wear off, they started discussing what their response should be. There were many serious decisions to be made, not the least of which was whether the United States should declare war on Russia. The president wanted to confer privately with his advisors. It was decided that everyone would reconvene in an hour. Stepping out of the skiff, Harvath saw Vela and flagged him over.
"How did it go?" the interrogator asked.
Harvath needed a case of water and a fistful of aspirin. Pinching the bridge of his nose to relieve his headache, he replied,
"Not well."
Vela had extracted a stunning confession from Sargon. Russia not only had a mole deep inside American intelligence, but had also orchestrated the attack on the SAD team in Anbar, the assassination of the Secretary of Defense, and the suicide bombing at the White House. All of the attacks had been designed to draw America into an all-out ground war with ISIS. Russia had been playing a media relations game, pretending not to be fully engaged in Syria, when the truth was they absolutely were. They needed ISIS defeated, but they couldn't do it on their own. There were two major factors at stake for Russia, one foreign, one domestic. Russia's only deep warm water port was located in the Syrian coastal city of Tartus. From this Mediterranean facility, Russia could project its naval power anywhere in the world. All of its other main ports were either ice-locked for large portions of the year or landlocked, which required Russian naval vessels to pass through straits controlled by other countries. If ISIS took over Syria, there was no telling what would happen to the treaty allowing the Russian naval facility at Tartus and their airbase north of there. It was in Russia's best interest that the status quo be maintained. But to do that, Russia had to focus most of its energy on defeating the CIA-backed rebels trying to topple the current government. It couldn't afford to open up a second front against ISIS. The United States, though, could. All America needed was a strong enough push. If it were repeatedly and dramatically humiliated, it would have no other choice but to act. Even America's war-weary citizens would eventually call for something to be done. Russia was certain of it. The attack on the White House was the icing on the cake. It would make for a dramatic ISIS propaganda video. But its real mission was to be an affront to America's patriotic sense of honor, a provocation that could absolutely not be ignored. Russia's other reason for wanting ISIS destroyed was domestic. The greatest population of non-Arabs traveling to Iraq and Syria to fight for ISIS were Russian speakers. They came in the thousands from Russian satellites like Chechnya and Ingushetia, Dagestan, and Abkhazia. Fighting with ISIS, they gained extensive hardcore combat experience. They learned how to build IEDs, as well as nuclear, biological, and chemical bombs. Eventually, many would return home to their unstable regions. They would train others, foment unrest, and launch revolutions. And as soon as one revolution started, others would follow. Russia would be overwhelmed, unable to respond. It was a nightmare scenario, one for which they could see only a single exit: getting the United States involved. It was stupid, outrageous, dangerous, deadly, and unquestionably a direct act of war. Nobody during Harvath's secure teleconference inside the skiff had debated that. What they had debated was the appropriate response. As far as Harvath was concerned, the only appropriate response was to hit the Russians so hard that they never attempted anything like it ever again. But that's what America thought it had done a decade ago, when small, man-portable nukes had been discovered secreted across the United States. The message, though, didn't appear to have gotten through. America was going to have to come up with something bigger. The problem at the moment was figuring out how far up the chain the plot went. Was it limited to just the GRU, or had it been sanctioned at the very top, from inside the Kremlin? There was only one way Harvath could see for them to figure that out, and he wanted to be the one to do it. But before he did, he wanted to know how Vela had been able to break Sergun so quickly and so thoroughly.
Your sense of smell is able to go straight to the part of the brain that stores memories, Vela explained. It can also impact your mood and performance, and does so without asking your conscious mind for permission. Essentially, what we've created is a chemical Trojan horse. It gets us into the brain, specifically to the amygdala, where fear memories are stored and potential threats are determined. It short-circuits the fight portion of the fight-or-flight mechanism. All the patient cares about is surviving. They become highly cooperative, malleable.
Why were you talking about Dante? Harvath asked.
When I interrogated Malevsky, he mentioned that Sergun liked to brag about how smart he was, the kinds of books he read. He spoke a lot about Dante. So I used that.
Used it how?
Vela knew Harvath was highly intelligent. He also knew that science could be boring, and so used the simplest analogy he could think of.
Fear is like an ice pick, he said. The deeper I can get it, the more acute the sensation. If I can work with images that are already in the subject's mind, it helps speed things up. That's why I try to gather as much background as possible.
Would it work on a stranger?
I suppose, Vela said, but it's probably going to take longer.
Harvath thanked him and headed for the stairwell. He wanted to get some fresh air before he had to return to the skiff. A plan was beginning to take shape in his mind, and he hoped taking a short walk around the property might help the rest of the pieces fall into place.
Chapter 47. The White House, Washington, D.C. President Porter waited until everyone else had left the Situation Room and then had Reed Carlton escorted down from upstairs. CIA Director McGee and Deputy Director Ryan were the only people who had been asked to remain behind. When they were all seated at the conference table, the president asked, "So, what does everyone think?" Carlton spoke first.
"I think it's doable. Harvath has operated multiple times in Syria."
"While augmented by Peshmerga fighters," Porter clarified.
"Yes, sir, that's correct."
"So he wasn't 100% on his own?"
"No, sir."
"The agency has a pretty reliable network of locals," McGee offered. "We can plug him in." The president looked at him.
"What does pretty reliable mean?"
"For Syria, it means the best you're going to get."
"Meaning the best that money can buy."
The CIA director nodded.
"What about inserting a team with him?"
"One white guy," Ryan replied. "One set of problems. Many white guys, many problems."
"But it could be done."
"Anything is possible. Yes, sir."
Porter looked back at Carlton. "Obviously, I have concerns and would feel better knowing someone had his back. Ultimately, though, this is your call. He's your man." Carlton appreciated the president's candor.
"Thank you, Mr. President. It's undoubtedly a trade-off, but I think the smaller the footprint, the better. I know he'd tell you that, too."
Porter gave one last push.
"This won't be like Berlin. We're talking about one of the GRU's top people. Harvath won't have any reliable backup in Damascus." "Correct. This won't be like Berlin. But we're going to have something we didn't have there."
"What's that?"
"Bait."
The president leaned back in his chair as he weighed his options. It was not an easy task. There was no instruction manual that came with this job, no index that directed you to page Y when faced with crisis X. When trouble came, it seemed to come pounding down all at once, like a hailstorm, or, more aptly, like a tidal wave. He had kept his circle to just the people with him in the room right now. He couldn't trust anyone else, not with something this sensitive, and not while the leak was still unidentified.
which made the president ask McGee, "How are you going to plug Harvath into the agency's network in Syria without any of this getting leaked?" It was a fair question, and one that the CIA director had already anticipated. "Eyewash," he replied.
"Eyewash?
We'll put out a memo into a few of our internal channels that says we have reason to believe that multiple CIA intelligence sources in Syria have been compromised. Until further notice, reporting from any Syrian sources is to be considered suspect. If the Russians do get a hold of the information, it'll leave them with the impression that we're in disarray when it comes to Syria. It'll also create some smoke for Harvath. If it gets reported that he's in Syria, the report will automatically be suspect. And, just to keep them guessing, we'll distribute a second memo to an even tighter circle higher up the food chain. That memo will put everyone on notice that we're sending in specialists to assess all of Syrian sources and that it's to be kept absolutely quiet."
"Won't your people resent being lied to like that?" Porter asked.
"Not as much as I'll resent having to do it, but in the intelligence game, sometimes it has to be done." Carlton and Ryan both nodded in agreement.
"And what about the leak itself?"
"We're still working on it from our end, but at this point, Harvath may end up being our best chance to uncover it."
"Meaning he gets a name?" the president replied.
"A name, an email address, a cell phone number. I'd be content just to know what kind of shampoo the guy uses. At least that would be a start, because right now, we really don't have anything."
Porter didn't like hearing it, but that was the situation. The people he was looking at were not paid to lie to him.
"And what about the second half of Harvath's proposed operation?"
"Obviously, that will depend on how successful he is in Damascus," Carlton replied.
Ryan then added, "Suffice it to say that if Damascus goes sideways, we're not going to be left with any choice."
The president let that sink in for a moment. A silence fell over the room. Finally, he said, "Then we'd better do everything we can, and hope like hell that he's successful."
Chapter 48. Amman, Jordan. Getting Harvath into Syria was the first challenge McGee and Ryan had to tackle. There was a secret airstrip the Pentagon had been using in the north of the country, but it was hundreds of kilometers away from Damascus. They contemplated flying him into Iraq and moving him across the desert, but that was fraught with problems, including potential contact with ISIS. The best bet was to land him in Amman, Jordan. From there, it was only 200 kilometers north to Damascus. All they had to do was get him across the Syrian border. A white Embraer Legacy 600 business jet with crimson stripes delivered Harvath from Malta to Amman in less than 3 hours. Upon his arrival, a covert CIA operative named Williams met him at the airport. Williams was a knock, operating in Jordan without any diplomatic cover. McGee had known him for decades and told Harvath he could trust him. Williams drove Harvath to a small apartment that the CIA kept off the books. After setting up a white backdrop, he took Harvath's picture in front of it and then another in profile looking out the window. He told him to help himself to whatever he found in the kitchen. He'd be back in the morning with his new passport to drive Harvath to the border. The tiny apartment was stuffy and probably hadn't been used in a while. Harvath opened a couple of windows and walked into the compact kitchen. Searching through the cabinets, he found a bottle of bullet bourbon. How Williams had laid his hands on it in a place like Amman was beyond him, but that's what made a knock a knock. They were highly resourceful. Pouring himself a drink, he grabbed a few pieces of pita bread and a container of hummus and walked back into the living room. The sounds of motorbikes, car horns, and radios ebbed and flowed through the open windows like a tide. The music was distinctly Arab. Turning out the lights, he pulled up a chair and took it all in as he ate. He referred to these moments as pre-compression. It was another term for getting his head in the game, of focusing in on where he was and what he needed to do. It was the opposite of decompression, which happened after an assignment was complete and he tried to put everything out of his mind and behind him. Getting up only to fix another drink, he sat at the window for over an hour, taking it all in, especially the conversations in Arabic as locals came and went along the sidewalk below. He was in a totally different world now, different people, different motivations, different rules. No matter how many times he had been sent to the Middle East, it always felt alien to him. There was no other way to describe it, and there was no other place in the world like it. After taking a shower, he lay down on the bed. An old ceiling fan turned slowly overhead, barely moving the air. He had hoped the bourbon would help him sleep, but his mind drifted to Lara.
"Married?" she had asked him when they first met. "Any kids?"
"No," he had replied.
"Divorced?"
"No."
"I knew it," she had said. "The haircut and the suit were a dead giveaway."
"Of what?" His hair was short, and he was wearing an expensive Brooks Brothers suit.
"Don't be defensive. Boston's a progressive city. We've got gay cops on the force."
He had laughed.
"I'm not gay." "So what's your problem then?" she had asked. "Never grew up? Peter Pan syndrome?"
"Just never met the right girl."
"You shouldn't be looking for a girl. You should be looking for a woman."
She was, of course, completely right. Then she had added,
"If you've come this far in life without finding the right person, the problem isn't them. It's you."
3 sentences. That's all they were. But they had completely changed his life. She reminded him that a perfect 10 doesn't exist, which at the time seemed almost funny coming from such an attractive woman. But he grew to understand what she meant.
"If you're hitting on 5 out of 6 cylinders with someone who truly cares about you," she said, "you should run all the way to the bank with it."
She was right. She was also an amazing woman. He knew he'd never meet someone like her again. And with that, he finally knew what he was going to do once this assignment was over. William showed up at dawn with 2 cups of Starbucks coffee and a large shopping bag.
"Sorry," he said, handing one of the cups to him. "The knockoff Dunkin' Donuts shop wasn't open yet."
Harvath smiled and took the lid off his cup. He hadn't been to Amman in a while.
"Which one has better coffee?"
"I don't like that they're ripping off an American brand, but they have damn good coffee. Cheaper, too. Donuts aren't bad," said Williams.
"Is that what's in your shopping bag?"
The knock grinned.
"Fancy guy like you gets a muffin," he replied, reaching into the bag and tossing one to him.
"Thanks," Harvath said. "Anything else?"
Williams peered into his shopping bag like an office party Santa Claus.
"I don't know. Let me look. Did you order a new set of Louis Vuitton luggage?"
"Not really my style."
"I didn't think so,"
the CIA man replied, as he removed a hard-sided Pelican briefcase and set it on the table.
"There you go. Special delivery."
Opening the lid, Harvath recognized the logo inside immediately. Palafox Solutions Group was a company out of Gulf Breeze, Florida. It was run by a SEAL who had retired as a master chief, gone into the private sector, and now had all sorts of interesting contracts. One of them was to build capability kits for the Central Intelligence Agency. Capability kits were loaded with all the things an intelligence or counterterrorism operative might need, but couldn't enter a foreign country with. Sometimes, all Harvath needed was a weapon. Sometimes he needed more. There was no one-size-fits-all solution. The first thing Harvath removed was a sand-colored modified Palafox 9mm Sig Sauer P226 pistol. It had bright green TrueGlow tritium fiber-optic day-night sights that allowed for fast target acquisition regardless of light conditions. Portions of the slide had been milled away to lessen the weapon's weight. It also helped to reduce muzzle flip and better assist recoil management. Accompanying the pistol was a sticky brand inside-the-waistband holster, spare magazines, and several boxes of TNQ frangible 9mm ammunition. There was also a jet-black ultra-compact single-shot Taser X26P, a flashlight, a compass, and a small trauma kit. It was a first-class setup. The last item Harvath removed was a stunning fixed-blade knife by Daniel Winkler called the Spike. The team at Palafox obviously knew what it was doing because the knife came in a leather sheath. Leather not only stropped the blade each time it was drawn, it was whisper quiet. Kydex looked cool, but it made a lot of noise. Next, Williams handed over Harvath's passport and an envelope full of pocket litter, receipts, a canceled boarding pass, a handful of business cards that looked like they'd been in someone's wallet for a while, that would back up his new identity. He looked at the passport and memorized the information. He was a Canadian from Ottawa. Williams handed him a series of articles, authored under his assumed name, dealing with conflict zones and humanitarian crises. They had been backdated to a faux blog the CIA sat on a commercial server in Canada. The photo Williams had taken the night before of him at the window served as his profile photo. He then handed Harvath a laminated international press credential on an Associated Press lanyard. It was the best the agency could do in such a short amount of time. Harvath looked it over, knowing it didn't have to be perfect. All it had to do was get him across the border. Once he was ready, he followed Williams downstairs to his car.